from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Louise Erdrich, the author of 13 novels and a number of volumes of poetry, short stories, and children's books. She won the National Book Critics Circle Award for her early work, Love Medicine. Plague of Doves, which we discussed with her when she was last with us on Forum, was a finalist for the Pulitzer, and it preceded and is linked to her most recent novel, part of an ongoing trilogy, her 14th, called The Roundhouse. Louise Erdrich joins us in studio. So glad to have you back here. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
First, I want to talk about this new book because it is, you really know how to write a page-turner. I mean, you know, there are great literary figures, and you are one of them, who open a whole world for us and give us this mythopoetic universe, as it were, a cosmos. I mean, but don't necessarily do the plot stuff that can make you want to just turn the pages.
Well,
you do it.
I like doing that.
Yeah, I know you do.
I really
do.
It's partly for me, but in this case, I was haunted by the political situation, that the underlying situation that this book in its events refers
to. Let's mention it again, The Roundhouse.
The Roundhouse. Yeah. The Roundhouse refers to a situation where it's very difficult to prosecute crimes of sexual violence on reservations. So I wanted to get this going as a suspense novel so that people would be pulled into it, want to read it, and get a sense of the history, why this is the case, and what's happening today in this book.
It's for educational purpose, in a sense.
It was for educational purposes alone, to make a suspense novel that people wanted to read.
You're like Kingsolver. You know, I mean, she said to me on a couple of occasions, I just want to make people turn the pages so they'll learn from what I have to tell them, whatever that may be.
But
this is also a story that's told, we've got The Perch of Time, but it's really a 13-year-old boy, Joe, your protagonist, and the sense of getting into the head of an adolescent boy. I mean, you do men pretty well, I must say. I mean,
Thank you.
Even going back to Love Medicine, I used to say, boy, she's really, you know, she knows the way men think and all that. But here, you know, you convince us with this voice. There are times when I think, could he really be that canny and smart? But I have to remind myself, this is told from a perch of time.
Right. Yeah. So I've kind of got it both ways, where he's looking back and he's able to comment on the things that are happening to him at the time, but he also it sometimes moves into a peer boy world where they are doing things that are absurd and getting themselves into ridiculous sorts of trouble, and I can just do conversations between them, and they're kind of geeky kids.
They're tricky lovers, in fact.
They love the next generation.
Right.
Yeah. In fact, the chapters all have titles from the first season of The Next Generation. They've MacGyvered a satellite dish that they can use to pull in the signals that come from as far away as Chicago, and they can see the episodes, and they're excited about each one that comes out. So the chapters each have the title from one of the episodes.
Is this from your own progeny, or you're totally your imagination?
It's totally my imagination, which is weird and warped. So I watch
you
them all.
Think
on
like a kid.
VHS.
Too, yeah.
I don't know. I think I had this kind of freedom as a child, where I grew up in a small North Dakota town where I could, and I went up to my grandparents on the reservation. I was able to have that kind of freedom, roaming the town, roaming the woods, really not having anyone worry about where I was at any particular hour, and being able to explore the world in a very different way that children than children can do now.
And with that, you had, I always liked the story, your father giving you a nickel for every story you came up with.
Yeah, he did.
We have to inflate that, you parents who are listening, who think you can encourage a young Louise Erdrich, child is father to the man. Let's not make that sexist, but that's Wordsworth. I mean, the sense of encouraging you to be a tale teller, to be a storyteller.
Well, that really is what I... That's why the suspense, because I like telling a story. A story has to keep people listening and interested. You know, I like telling something that has an ongoing plot. I diverge from the plot. I make it difficult sometimes to get back to it, but it's always I wanted this one to be tighter and to keep the thread going.
You definitely keep the thread going. There's a sense, too, well, let's talk about what you want people to learn about those differences, those difficulties of, because in the afterword you talk about one out of three women going through sexual violation on the reservations and the difficulty getting justice because of the two systems, the tribal system on the one hand and the law that is outside the tribe.
Yes, and you know, when I say the word jurisdictional, it just sort of, now don't turn off your, you know, don't change the dial, because it's just a really, it's tough to explain all this. That's why it's in a book that has a detective kind of mystery to be solved. But there are reasons for this. There's historical reasons for the land being in different hands, and you have to go to the tribal, to the FBI, to different entities in order to find the right person to help you through this system. And how many women are able to actually get this done for themselves, to actually work through this system? That's the first thing. The next thing is that if it goes to the federal level, they have a lot more to worry about than one woman's misery.
Talking with Louise Erdrich, and by the way, her new novel, Around House, has been nominated for a National Book Award winner this year. Jennifer Egan may get pushed out finally after serving 2 years that was the Pulitzer. You were actually a finalist with Flight of Doves for the Pulitzer, and I was thinking, they didn't decide on a Pulitzer this year. That's
no,
why I
they
mentioned
didn't. That's right.
Jenny Egan in terms of the fiction award.
Yeah.
But you plan trilogies? Do you think, you know, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to write a trilogy, or is it just that, like, because this is connected to Flight of Doves?
Yeah, it is, and I didn't plan it, but when I was waiting for some sort of story to come to me, waiting with this haunting situation in mind, I realized that I had a 13-year-old talking to me, kind of telling me this story, and I wanted to go with it. And I thought, well, he's the perfect age if I set this in the first season of The Next Generation. He'd be the perfect age to be the son of the judge and Geraldine who get married in Plague of Doves. So it turned out I
was
had
how you pronounce
connected
his name,
them.
The judge? Basil?
Basil. Coutts. Right. Yeah. And so it ended up, yes, it's connected thematically. And as I wrote this, another one came to mind, and I thought, I'm going to write yet another book, and it'll be perfect. It'll be three books, and it'll be connected by this particular theme, somewhat about the same people.
You have staked out territory here. I mean, in terms of, it's what Faulkner called my little postage stamp of reality. Instead
right.
of Yaknapatawpha County.
And you can say it. You,
well, no, but I mean, you've got the genealogies, you've got the myths and the connectedness in the stories and everything. It's rich. I don't think there's anybody else doing this, really, at the level you're doing it since Faulkner.
I don't know. Maybe that's why I get this. I do have this question sometimes, whether I've been greatly influenced by Faulkner or what it is. I suppose I have, but I also am somehow, because I never left North Dakota till I was 18, I put down all of those formational memories as a child there. And so I keep going back to them. The most convincing people seem to come from where I grew up.
There's an old saw about writing that, you know, you have enough, if you have enough material in your youth, you can mine it for the rest of your life.
Is there really? Well, I've never heard that, but maybe that's the case for me. But my parents still live there, and my family's there, so, and my reservation's there, so I go back all the time. I don't live that. I live 3 hours from the border, so.
You have certainly mined a great deal of material from the reservation, from your own experiences, and also from the Germanic side of your family. I mean,
oh yes, absolutely.
Where does the French come in, though? Because I think your mother was half French,
right? So the French have been turned into semi-native people, the Métis, and that was the interesting that happened during the fur trade. You know, French voyageurs came over sort of looking to get wealthy in the fur trade, and in order to make alliances that would be profitable, married Ojibwe, mainly Ojibwe, Menominee, mostly Algonquin women, and in that way got turned into native people. Their children became native, and they joined in. Now, this is very different than any other, really than any other set of Europeans who came over. You know, certainly the Puritans did not marry into the tribes they met. It was a very different sort of world, and so it's an ongoing culture. It's like a Creole culture that exists out in Manitoba, Saskatchewan, North Dakota, into Montana. And some of the people here have some French words that still to this day exist in their language.
That sounds like Creole.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
I guess the Ojibwe people were known as the original people. Where does that name come from?
It comes from Anishinaabe, and that's the Anishinaabemowin is the language of the people, and it's being revived at a very with very great intensity right now, because the language was really nearly wiped out with two generations of people going to boarding schools, so that now young people have decided they're going to go into immersion schools. One of my daughters is an immersion school teacher. She's working. She's managing.
Learning Ojibwe.
Yeah.
So is my daughter. I told you. She studied at the University of Michigan. Yeah.
And it's a huge movement to go back and really revitalize the language. Yeah. Interesting.
Well, needed. I mean, these indigenous people's languages, tribal languages, are disappearing, mm-hmm. and the whole culture is embedded in them. I'm not going to get on my soapbox here, but I think we feel the same about
it. We feel
this.
The same way about it, that there is a whole world view that is very important to understand and to communicate in. And when people speak Ojibwe, for instance, there are very few nouns. They're mostly verbs. And it's a language of doing and of community and of seeing, instead of seeing the animate and the inanimate in the world, and seeing a spirit that really flows through everything.
It's like we were talking to Sandra Cisneros yesterday, who I should mention, these two writers saw each other, and Louise happened to be here as well, and it was like, well, it was really lovely to see the kind of embrace and affection that they have for each other.
Yeah,
but,
it was great to see.
You know, she talks about the material and the spiritual world not being different, you know, with respect to, say, something like magic realism.
Right. Well, I think that's very much, but it also has to do with Catholicism, because as I grew up, I really believed that miracles should be part of everyday life. I really believed all of it, that so... in Ojibwe, the Ojibwe world, of course, the spirit does move through everything, and you have a sense that there is a living spirit. Even the word for insect, manaduns, it means a tiny spirit. So everything is alive.
Even bugs are spiritual.
Even say you see a stone, the word for stone is animate. It's not inanimate. It's animate. It's got an animating spirit.
You talk about your relationship to Catholicism now. I mean, I always see in my mind Sister Leopolda, you know, trying to drive those demons out in love medicine.
Right. Well, in this book, there's I have a very different character, a priest, Father Travis, who is a former Marine, and he's very good at shooting gophers, and he's also a very complex individual. the boys spy on him. It's 1988, so he's watching aliens on a VHS player, and they're shocked that he probably owns this VHS tape. You know, they're just, and he's drinking a Michelob, and Joe says, "Oh my God, it's almost enough to want to make a boy want to be a Catholic just to watch this priest." So he's a sign of the outside world coming onto the reservation and being somewhat more sophisticated than anyone's ever witnessed a priest being. Plus, he's in great shape. You know, he can...
He's a Marine.
He can outrun anybody.
in good shape, and I suppose you could say urbanized now.
Right,
or
right.
Assimilated in ways that... That come through just with the hybridization of what you've described as this particular character, which is Michelob.
And so they're watching him thinking that perhaps they suspect him of a crime, but it turns out it wouldn't be possible for him to commit this crime. They get basically tossed around the room by this priest, and I just had a lot of fun writing him because, in a way, he's a comical figure because of his enormous strength and the way that they don't quite anticipate being caught, tossed, creatively called obscene names without ever using a bad word.
These are boys that remind one almost of like Huck and Tom, you know. I mean, adventure and sleuthing and everything, except that, of course, it's a grim story and it hits so close to home. But
exactly.
You manage to bring in these comedic elements. And, I mean, sometimes you're really quite funny, even though the story is really quite grim. I found myself, in fact, just not, which is a good sign, particularly when you're writing a suspenseful note, not knowing what's Louise going to do next with me here? You know, as a reader, shifting me around.
Well, it's partly that, you know, the elders in this story have incredible license to tease, to be to talk about their erotic pasts, to
You got a pretty hot grandma here, in fact.
Right. She has some great memories that she enjoys sharing. We have a 112-year-old great uncle who has not given up on his love life. Yeah.
And why do that?
I mean,
especially in an era of Viagra, right?
Yeah.
talking with Louise Erdrich.
Oh, well, this was 88, but he's going natural.
And it's a story of a brutal rape on a Native American reservation, and the son, Joe Kutz's 13-year-old boy, who is the narrator's attempt to find out really what happened and to seek justice. It is, as I said, a very compelling novel. And I was saying to Louise off air, those of you who remember, nobody calls you Karen anymore, do they?
Yes.
Do they?
My parents do sometimes, and I was at my 40th high school reunion in Wahpeton, North Dakota, and I'm still Karen.
Still Karen. Yeah. I was Mike at mine.
But
I was talking with Louise, those of you who remember the history, she was married to Michael Doris, and they used to write together on books, and there were some tragic events that occurred, including his suicide. And just, it's a tough question to ask, but whether you've grown more since his death, and since, well, you two split up, and
right,
in many ways
that happened pretty much simultaneously.
Yeah.
And so, I can't really say. I think that my growth as a writer has been to decide in the past two books that I wanted to tell a story straight through with one narrator, basically. And that's been a very interesting development for me. Because I used to work with these multiple narrators and break up the book and break up the narrative. And now I'm getting these voices that just want to continue. So I just go with them.
This is a book, the new one, The Roundhouse, really, where you're struggling not only with justice and how it's rendered, but it's really a book about revenge and about retaliation. Mm-hmm.
It is, but it's, it's a book about where you are forced to go when in the absence of justice. And that's why Joe, the narrator, who is just 13, remembers this summer of his life so searing, with such searing clarity. He remembers that he takes on the burden of justice for a system that's broken and for parents who are fragile. And he has to realize this, all of this in one summer, that his parents are not capable, strong individuals anymore. And he's the one who decides to make decisions regarding justice.
What happens to his mother after the rape? This place that gives the book its title, Sacred Place, in fact.
The Roundhouse is a sacred place.
Yes.
That's right.
But it's, I mean, your rendering of what happens to her, I mean, she really falls into pretty bad depression and everything.
Yes.
Is close to the mark, it seemed to me. I mean, did you read any case studies or did you just essentially know this from what you had learned and picked up?
No, I knew this from knowing, women.
From life.
From life, yeah. Just from life. And I knew it was not something that people sort of think, well, I mean, women get this tremendous violation to deal with on their own sometimes. I mean, it's thought to be something that a woman has to just get over somehow. And I've even heard during my book tours, women have said, you know, I was just told, now you learned your lesson. I mean, there's been this incredibly shocking, I think, discussion of is there a legitimate rape? You know, this kind of discussion has come out
Missouri
during the election.
Senate candidate, yeah.
Exactly. So she is trying to get over this, but it is a family tragic. It is a tragic family situation. She can't get over it. She's healing any way she can. And she really can't leave her room. I mean, she really has what would be termed now post-traumatic stress. Just that she isn't.
And agoraphobia.
Agoraphobia. She has things that would have a name, I suppose, now and maybe had a name then. But for her, that's just how she's trying to get over this, by not moving, by not going anywhere, by not eating, by, you know, just remaining still in one place.
Now, this all, as you said, takes place in 1988, whereas the Plague of Doves, its predecessor, takes place in 1911.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, as I said, the two are linked.
They're linked. So, and I think the link here is a legacy, a historical legacy, in which justice is difficult or impossible to obtain, and what that does to a community.
So we're talking about a family, a community, mm-hmm. a tribe, people.
Right. And what that does to a young person who decides that the burden of solving this is upon him. Sometimes when you leave a book, you wish that it wasn't over. I mean, I had such an extraordinary experience in writing this book of being pulled along.
You were inhabiting him, weren't you?
Yes. Or he was inhabiting me. So this last character, I haven't been able to let go of him yet, and he's right now, he's my favorite. I wish I was still writing the book, I guess.
Is the third trilogy is it gestating? Is it coming into picture into focus?
Well, it's hard to say. When you're on a book tour, your brain is just focused on the next, whether you can go on to the next venue and still have some lucid thought. I haven't really thought about the book.
It's Thursday. It must be San Francisco.
I know.
But it must be embryonic. I mean, in some
it must be there.
Yeah.
I'm really hoping it's there because I've loved working on both of these books now. They've been just almost a magical occurrence for me to be able to come upstairs and find my characters over and over still waiting for me. So I'm hoping that's going to happen again.
I'm also wondering about the tendency that literary folks have to often categorize, Louise Erdrich, Native American writer, mm-hmm. Sherman Alexie, Leslie Marmon Silko, Scott Momenday, you're all kind of bracketed, you know, as mm-hmm. Native American. And yet, you know, the tribe histories are so different and the diversity is obviously so wide-ranging. How do you respond to that? Or how do you feel about that?
Well, I'm of mixed... here I am of mixed heritage. I'm of mixed mind. You know, sometimes I think it's really useful because a lot of these books have gained in recognition through the academic world. And in order to do that, you have to group books together and present them as a course. So the books are also read in women's or multicultural studies, you know, all sorts of courses. And at the same time, I really feel that the books have a transfiguring humanity that reaches across all cultural barriers, and that Sherman's books do this, and Leslie Marmon Silko's books do this as well. I mean, they're just our Native writers who you read as human. Other human beings. So,
universal storytelling. I mean, yes, stories having universal themes to them and so forth. And yet, you want to preserve the identity too. You want to keep it in some ways native, many of you, no?
Exactly. You have. I think when a writer writes thoroughly out of an identity, that adds depth and richness to a story, but it's really no different from the way any writer writes out of their own background. I mean, Toni Morrison writes out of her background, Russell Banks out of his, Philip Roth out of Newark. You know, it's something that you have to do as a writer.
You've been listening to a special holiday edition of Forum. Our guest was author Louise Erdrich, whom I spoke with on October 18th. Her new novel is The Roundhouse. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Amanda Stupai is our engagement producer. David Marks provided online support. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.